Welcome to The Science of Murder. This podcast discusses the intersection of crimes, mostly murder and serial killings, and the science that is used to catch the perpetrators. We will shine the spotlight on some of the people responsible for the advances in science and techniques that were used to catch murderers. We will talk about how many notorious serial killers managed to evade being discovered, as well as how they were ultimately caught and convicted. We will also discuss times where science, or the people yielding it, failed in their quest to catch a killer. My name is Lissa, and I'll be your host for the discussions of The Science of Murder. I'm not a forensic scientist, psychologist, or legal professional. I'm just one of the many people who are interested in the topic of true crime and its perpetrators. I am curiously fascinated in the how and why these crimes happen and how science has developed to catch and convict these criminals. I am here to open up those conversation topics that still aren't quite acceptable to the mainstream, but also ground them in my own love of science, scientific techniques, and psychological studies. I know I'm not the only one out here fascinated by the science of murder and true crime, so I want us to find each other and learn together. Today we are discussing the science of poisoning and toxicology. For centuries, poison was the ghost of the criminal world. While a blood stain is a loud, chaotic declaration of violence, a toxin is a whisper. The term inheritance powder, or poudre de succession, became synonymous with arsenic in 17th century France, specifically during the infamous Affair of the Poisons. It was the weapon of choice for the patient killer because it was odorless, tasteless, and most importantly, its symptoms mimicked common natural illnesses like cholera or food poisoning. Before the birth of modern toxicology, a murderer could sprinkle a fine white powder into a family member's soup and watch them wither away over days or weeks. To the doctors of the time, the vomiting and abdominal pain looked like a tragic act of God rather than an act of malice. This created a terrifying error where the law was powerless because science had no way to see the weapon once it entered the human system. The turning point in forensics came when scientists stopped looking for the powder in the jar and started looking for the chemical signature in the body. The inheritance powder era ended not because people stopped being greedy, but because science developed the Marsh test in 1836. This was the first time a chemist could take a piece of human tissue, process it, and produce a physical metallic mirror of arsenic as undeniable proof in a courtroom. Today, we've moved from simple chemical reactions to mass spectrometry, where we can identify a single molecule of a toxin amidst billions of other cells. We are no longer just looking for poison. We are looking for the specific metabolites that prove a substance was processed by a living person. But the Marsh test was just the beginning. To truly unmask a killer, we have to look deeper than a metallic mirror. We have to look at the body's own internal machinery, a field known as pharmacokinetics. Pharmacokinetics is the study of how the human body moves a substance through its complex biological systems. A poison's journey follows four distinct stages, universally known by the acronym ADME: absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, which serves as the forensic map for every toxicological investigation. The first stage is absorption, the process by which a substance breaches the body's defenses to enter the systemic circulation. The speed and efficiency of this process is dictated entirely by the route of entry. Inhalation provides nearly instantaneous access to the bloodstream through the vast surface area of the lungs, making gases like carbon monoxide or aerosolized toxins immediately lethal. Injection is the most direct route as it bypasses all protective barriers to deliver a concentrated dose straight into the veins. However, ingestion remains the most common forensic route. Here, a substance must survive the highly acidic environment of the stomach before being absorbed, typically through the lining of the small intestine. For the patient killer, even dermal absorption through the skin via fentanyl patches or specialized nerve agents offers a slow, stealthy alternative that can evade immediate detection. Once the barrier is breached, the toxin moves into the second stage, distribution. Once a poison is in the blood, it is carried to various tissues and organs, but this movement is rarely uniform. Distribution is a game of chemical affinity. High potency toxins such as heroin or volatile gases are lipophilic, meaning they are designed to cross the blood-brain barrier with terrifying speed to attack the central nervous system. Other substances participate in a process called sequestration, where they effectively hide in specific biological vaults. Heavy metals like arsenic have an incredible affinity for keratin, meaning they will leave the blood to deposit permanently in the hair and nails. Others may bury themselves in fat cells or the bone matrix, creating a chemical archive. This is why a toxicologist can exhume a skeleton years after the blood has vanished and still find the undeniable evidence of a life ended by poison. The third stage is metabolism, or biotransformation, which represents the body's frantic attempt to neutralize and break down the foreign invader. This chemical warfare occurs primarily in the liver, where specialized enzymes attack the poison to strip it of its lethality. During this process, the liver transforms the original parent drug into different chemical fragments known as metabolites. This stage holds immense forensic significance. In many cases, the parent drug disappears from the system so quickly that it becomes invisible. We must instead hunt for the metabolites to prove the crime. For instance, finding the specific metabolite 6-MAM in a victim's tissue proves they used heroin with absolute certainty, even if every trace of the original heroin has already been processed and destroyed by the liver's enzyme. Finally, the journey concludes with excretion, the stage where the body eliminates the remnants of the substance. While the kidneys serve as the primary exit route via urine, toxins can also be purged through bile, sweat, saliva, or even the exhaled breath, the very principle that allows for the scientific accuracy of a roadside breathalyzer. However, this final stage also presents the toxicological catch-22. If a poison has an exceptionally high excretion rate, such as GHB, it may be entirely flushed from a living victim's system before they even realize a crime has occurred. This leads to the tragic negative toxicology report, where the science appears to fail because the body's own filtration system worked too efficiently, erasing the chemical footprints of the perpetrator. In a poisoning homicide, the investigator must prove presence, potency, and pathology. If the victim did not die instantly, their body's attempt to fight the poison leaves a trail in the form of vomita and excreta, which are concentrated sources of the toxin. Even in quiet poisonings, the final physiological reactions, like convulsions, leave physical traces. The pathologist looks for an internal snapshot within protected vaults of evidence. The vitreous humor in the eye is the gold standard because it is isolated from postmortem redistribution, which is a phenomenon where drugs leak out of organs like the liver after death and artificially spike blood concentration levels. Gastric contents help determine the delivery method and the ingestion to death window, while the liver and bile act as filters that hold a footprint of the toxin even after it's cleared the blood. However, calculating that concentration is complicated by a phenomenon we call postmortem redistribution, or PMR. I like to think of it as toxicological movement after death. Once the heart stops and the cell membranes begin to degrade, drugs stored in high concentration organs like the liver or lungs begin to leak out into surrounding blood. If a pathologist takes a blood sample directly from the heart, the results might show a lethal overdose that didn't actually exist at the time of death. To combat this ghost spike, we prioritize peripheral blood samples, usually from the femoral artery in the leg, because they are less susceptible to this organ leakage. It is a constant battle to ensure the chemistry we see on the bench reflects the reality of the victim's final moments, not the decay of the body itself. When exhumation is required, success depends on whether the poison is organic or inorganic. Organic proteins and poisons like morphine, cocaine, and cyanide are complex molecules that usually vanish as soil bacteria and putrefaction, break them down. An exception is strychnine, which is remarkably hardy. Inorganic heavy metals like arsenic, lead, thallium, and antimony are elemental and do not rot. Segmental hair analysis can be used to show a timeline of poisoning because arsenic has a high affinity for keratin. By cutting the hair into segments, analysts can determine if the poisoning was recent or occurred months prior. While cremation is the ultimate forensic eraser that incinerates organic toxins and gases, certain inorganic survivors like antimony or traces of arsenic can sometimes be detected in the cremains or within the dental pulp. In the laboratory, we don't just ask what killed a victim, we ask how the substance broke the biological machine. Toxicology categorizes substances by their chemical nature and the specific physiological havoc they wreak on the human body. Inorganic poisons are often elemental and do not break down over time, which makes them a gift for the forensic science, as they persist long after death. This group includes heavy metals like lead, mercury, thallium, and the infamous arsenic. While arsenic is technically a metalloid, we treat it as a heavy metal forensically because it works through bioaccumulation, effectively gumming up the works by binding to cellular enzymes and preventing life-sustaining reactions. Corrosives are the loud inorganic poisons, consisting of strong acids like sulfuric acid or alkalis like lye. They cause immediate physical tissue destruction upon contact, essentially melting the proteins in the throat and stomach. Finally, anions like cyanide are masters of molecular disguise. They enter the mitochondria and prevent cells from using oxygen, causing the victim to suffocate at the molecular level, even with lungs full of air. Organic poisons are carbon-based compounds that are often more difficult to detect because the body begins breaking them down into different daughter molecules almost immediately. This category includes volatile organics like ethanol, methanol, and chloroform, which can have profound effects on the central nervous system. It also includes alkaloids, which are nitrogen-heavy compounds derived from nature, but often refined by humans, such as morphine, cocaine, and nicotine. The modern frontier consists of synthetic organics, such as organophosphate pesticides that overstimulate the nervous system until it collapses, or common pharmaceuticals that become lethal synthetic organic poisons if the dose is high enough. Biological toxins, or biotoxins, are weapons grown in nature rather than manufactured in a lab. Microbial poisons produced by bacteria such as botulism are among the most poisonous substances known to man, blocking nerve signals to the muscles and leading to total respiratory failure. This category also includes fungal mycotoxins. Phytotoxins are plant-derived, including ricin from castor beans, strychnine, wolfsbane, taxine from yew trees, and aconite. Zootoxins are the venomous byproducts produced by snakes, spiders, and scorpions, which are almost always injected to bypass the digestive system's attempts to neutralize them. Lastly, gaseous poisons like carbon monoxide act as asphyxiants by stealing the seat on the red blood cell from oxygen, while hydrogen sulfide paralyzes the respiratory center of the brain for almost instant death. This brings us to the most fundamental law of toxicology, first dictated by Paracelsus. The dose makes the poison. In the lab, we quantify this through the LD50, or the median lethal dose, the specific amount of a substance required to kill 50% of a test population. As a scientist, I'm often looking at the therapeutic index, which is the window between a dose that heals and a dose that kills. In cases involving invisible poisons like insulin or digoxin, the killer isn't introducing a foreign substance. They are simply pushing a naturally occurring one past the biological breaking point. Identifying these requires us to move beyond the simple positive or negative result. We must calculate the exact concentration to prove that the medicine was actually the murder weapon. In the clinical setting, we often identify a poison by the physical wreckage it leaves behind, known as toxidromes. These are sets of symptoms that act as a chemical fingerprint for the investigator. When an investigator finds a victim with cherry red skin, the biology points towards carbon monoxide or cyanide because the toxin prevents cells from utilizing oxygen, leaving the blood highly oxygenated and bright red even as tissues die. Conversely, a victim with pinpoint pupils or miosis is a classic indicator of morphine or opioids due to profound central nervous system depression, where the parasympathetic system overrides the body's ability to dilate. The senses of smell and sight provide further clues, such as a faint garlic odor on the breath or within tissue indicating arsenic or thallium poisoning caused by chemical byproducts released during metabolism. The scent of bitter almonds during an internal examination is the most famous warning sign of cyanide ingestion. Though only about 60% of the population has the genetic ability to detect the smell, Perhaps the most visceral and terrifying taxidrome is opisthotonus, most commonly associated with strychnine. This is characterized by violent, involuntary muscle spasms, so intense that the body arches backwards, supported only by the head and the heels, because the poison has stripped away the nervous system's brakes. Beyond the clinical confines of the laboratory, poison has been the primary engine of political sabotage and cultural myth. The 1978 umbrella murder of Bulgarian dissident Georgi Markov on Waterloo Bridge remains a chilling example of a precision chemical strike. Markov was struck by a modified umbrella that fired a tiny 1.7 millimeter platinum iridium pellet into his tissue. The pellet contained a mere 0.2 milligrams of ricin, a biological toxin so lethal it inhibits protein synthesis at the cellular level. This dose was so minuscule that it would have been undetectable had the pathologist not found the microscopic pellet during the autopsy. In the modern era, exotic substances like polonium-210 have replaced inheritance powders for state-level assassinations, as seen in the 2006 death of Alexander Litvinenko. Polonium-210 is a rare alpha emitter that is harmless outside the body, but destroys internal organs through massive radiation damage once ingested. Historically, Aqua Tofana was a 17th century social service created by Julia Tofana for women in abusive marriages. Disguised as a cosmetic oil labeled Manna of St. Nicholas, this tasteless mixture of arsenic, lead, and belladonna caused over 600 deaths by mimicking a natural physiological decline. This legacy of stealth is mirrored in the work of Agatha Christie, whose training as a pharmacy dispenser allowed her to write about toxins with such clinical accuracy that her descriptions of thallium poisoning in The Pale Horse famously helped real-world readers identify symptoms and save lives. Modern toxicology has moved far beyond simple color change tests to a high-stakes game of molecular hide-and-seek. Physical symptoms provide the trail, but the modern lab provides the conviction. We've moved from smelling almonds to counting atoms. The primary workhorses are gas chromatography and liquid chromatography, paired with mass spectrometry. Chromatography serves as the sorting phase, separating a biological sample into individual components as they move through a microscopic column at different speeds. Mass spectrometry then serves as the identification phase, shattering those molecules into a unique fragmentation pattern or molecular fingerprint, which is identified against digital libraries with nearly 100% certainty. Advances in 2026 allow us to use keratinized matrices like hair and nails as biological black box to create a long-term medical history. Segmental hair analysis can track the administration of a poison chronologically, while nails provide a stable medium resilient to environmental tampering. To combat the rise of novel psychoactive substances or designer drugs, we use high-resolution mass spectrometry to calculate molecular mass down to 5 decimal places, identifying new poisons based solely on their atomic weight. Finally, the study of the forensic microbiome allows us to sequence the DNA of bacteria inside a corpse to detect the chemical aftershocks of a poison, even after the toxin itself has been fully metabolized and vanished from the blood. While much of our discussion focuses on the postmortem, toxicology is equally critical and perhaps even more high stakes when the victim is still alive. In these cases, the lab isn't just seeking a cause of death, it's seeking a window into a stolen period of time. This brings us to the harrowing field of drug-facilitated crimes, specifically drug-facilitated sexual assault. Unlike the loud poisons that leave the body arched in opisthotonos, these substances are designed to be silent. They are the ultimate whispers. The two primary predators in this chemical landscape are gamma-hydroxybutyrate, GHB, and scopolamine. GHB is a central nervous system depressant that occurs naturally in the body in trace amounts, which makes the lab's job of proving exogenous or outside administration a nightmare. Scopolamine, often called the devil's breath, is an alkaloid derived from the borrachero tree. It induces a state of passive obedience. The victim remains conscious and able to walk and talk, but their free will is effectively deleted. This leads us to what I call the toxicological catch-22. For a scientist to prove a crime occurred, we must rely on the ADME process we discussed earlier. However, the very substances used in these crimes are characterized by extremely short half-lives. The half-life is the time it takes for the concentration of a substance in the blood to reduce by half. GHB, for example, has a half-life of only 30 to 60 minutes. Here is the failure of science in action. Because these drugs cause profound retrograde amnesia, the victim often does not realize a crime has occurred for 8, 12, or even 24 hours. By the time they arrive at a hospital for a forensic exam, the final stage of the biological pathway, excretion, has already won the race. The drug has been filtered through the kidneys and vanished from the bloodstream. This creates a heartbreaking scenario where a victim's lived experience is dismissed because the gold standard science cannot provide a physical molecule to back it up. In these cases, we must turn to urine toxicology, which provides a slightly longer window, or even hair testing weeks later, hoping the vault of the hair follicle trapped a single fleeting ghost of the dose. To see these principles from the ADME pathway to the permanence of the biological vault collide in the real world, we look at a man who turned his workplace into a laboratory of death. Graham Young, known as the teacup poisoner. Young was a clinical sociopath who used his workers as human petri dishes. He didn't use a single high-energy dose. He used the inheritance powder method of small, chronic doses of antimony and thallium. Because he understood the ADME process, he watched as his victims' bodies absorbed and distributed the toxins, causing symptoms that doctors misdiagnosed as the flu or exhaustion. It was only after his arrest that the permanent record I mentioned earlier came into play. When his victims were exhumed, investigators didn't need fresh blood. They used segmental hair analysis and bone sampling to find the thallium that had been locked into the keratin and calcium. Each millimeter of hair acted as a calendar, proving exactly when Young had spiked their teeth. His case remains the perfect forensic bridge. It shows how a killer uses the body's slow metabolism to hide, only for the body's own structural stability, the hair and bone, to eventually betray them. Sometimes the toxicology of the living involves not a single victim, but an entire ward. We see this case with Beverly Allen, a nurse in a British hospital who became one of the most notorious angels of death. Her weapon wasn't a rare plant or a state-level isotope. It was insulin. Insulin is a life-saving hormone, but in the hands of a poisoner, it's a perfect weapon. When Allen injected healthy children with massive doses of insulin, it caused their blood sugar to plummet, a state of hypoglycemia, leading to seizures, coma, and permanent brain damage. This case highlights a specific laboratory challenge. How do you prove a poison is a murder when the body already produces it naturally? Allet's victims, ranging from 7-week-old infants like Liam Taylor to young children like 5-year-old Bradley Gibson, suffered sudden, inexplicable cardiac arrests and respiratory failures. For weeks, the ward believed it was cursed by a run of bad luck or a mystery virus. Because these children were already ill, their collapses were initially viewed as natural complications of their conditions. However, the truth was hidden in the toxidromes. Many of the victims displayed profound hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. In a healthy child, the body should be able to regulate this. In Allet's victims, the sugar levels were so low they were incompatible with life. The science finally caught up with Allet through the analysis of 5-month-old victim named Paul Crampton. During his third life-threatening collapse, doctors managed to draw a blood sample before treating him. When the sample reached the lab, the results were dynamite. The breakthrough came through the analysis of C-peptide. When the human pancreas creates insulin, it produces C-peptide as a byproduct in a 1-to-1 ratio. If a patient has high insulin levels but zero C-peptide, the science proves with absolute certainty that the insulin did not come from the body. Paul Crampton's blood showed a massive lethal spike in insulin, but virtually no C-peptide. This 1-to-0 ratio proved incontrovertible molecular proof that the insulin was exogenous, introduced from the outside. It wasn't a biological failure, it was an injection. It was an act of malice. This is the precision of modern toxicology, using the body's own metabolic ratios to unmask a killer hiding in plain sight. As the investigation widened, even the dead began to speak. When 15-month-old Claire Peck's remains were exhumed, the lab found traces of lidocaine, a drug used to treat cardiac arrest that never should have been present in her system. The investigation also revealed that Allet had reported the keys to the ward's insulin refrigerator missing during the height of the attacks. By the time the trial concluded, science had proven that Allet was responsible for 4 murders and 9 attempted murders, or cases of grievous bodily harm. Her case remains the definitive example of why the laboratory must look past the natural symptoms to find the chemical truth. It illustrates the transition from a mystery run of bad luck to a high-stakes forensic capture where the silent C-peptide became the loudest witness in the room. In the end, toxicology is the science of finding what was meant to be hidden. Whether it's the C-peptide ratio that unmasked Beverly Owlett or the thallium locked in the hair of Graham Young's victims, the body acts as a meticulous historian. It records every dose, every chemical insult, and every metabolic struggle. The invisible weapon era ended because we stopped guessing at symptoms and started measuring molecules. We moved from the era of inheritance powders, where a killer could hide behind a diagnosis of cholera, to the era of high-resolution mass spectrometry, where we can weigh an atom to five decimal places. Science has stripped the stealth from the poisoner, proving that even a whisper leaves a permanent echo in the blood. As we've seen, the toxicologist's battle is one of precision, finding a needle in a haystack of biological noise. But what happens when the crime is not a whisper, but a roar? What happens when evidence isn't a single molecule, but a mountain of skeletal remains buried beneath a family home? What happens when the biological vault isn't a hair follicle, but a crawl space? In our next episode, we leave the sterile environment of the toxicology lab for the damp, dark soil of Norwood Park, Illinois. We will step into the world of John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown. We will discuss how Gacy maintained a mask of sanity while 33 young men vanished into the crawl space beneath his floorboards. But more importantly, we will look at the forensic anthropology required to speak for the dead when there is no blood or tissue left to test. From the chemistry of adipocere to the breakthrough of mitochondrial DNA, we will see how science eventually tore down the walls of the house on Summerdale Avenue. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to The Science of Murder to continue learning along with me. If you found today's deep dive into the chemistry of death fascinating, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred provider. Reviews help other science-minded true crime fans find the show, so I encourage you to tell your accomplices, I mean friends, to learn along with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the Owlett or Young cases or any future topics you'd like to suggest. You can find me on Instagram or Patreon as Science of Murder, or reach me directly at scienceofmurder@gmail.com. I'm Lissa, and thank you for joining me for this discussion on the history and mystery of toxicology. Stay curious, stay scientific. And I'll see you under the floorboards in our next episode.